Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, and this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo, and today I have a recent Firebird Book Award winning author to share with you. He is Alfredo Botello, and the winning book is titled 180 Days. Alfredo is a screenwriter and a Fulbright Fellow in Architecture and a Nickel Fellow in Screenwriting. In addition to screenplays, he has written for the San Francisco Examiner magazine, Metropolis, Diablo, Surface, the Utney Reader, Style, the East Bay Express, and the Monthly. He also co-owns two dive bars in downtown Oakland, Radio Bar and the Ruby Room. And at home, he dotes on his two corgis, George and Dottie. And we are about to have some fun, so welcome to the network, Alfredo.
Well, thank you so much, Pat, for having me on and for the introduction. And yes, in addition to George and Dottie, I'm right now sitting in bed with two kitties, Lester and Bella Kitty. So the petting zoo is here.
Well, listen, congratulations on winning the Firebird Book Awards.
Well, thanks so much. I mean, I was thrilled to get that email back and to hear about it. And yeah, I've ordered the stickers to put on books, so I will be showing off my stickers. Very excited.
And they've been sent, so they should be en route as we speak. Listen, before we dig into your books, inquiring minds want to know about these dive bars. Maybe just give us a peek into how that all came about.
Sure. So they came about kind of as a fluke. In a past life when I was younger, I was working in a small architecture office for 6 or 7 years. Lovely people. It was an office in a little old converted house. We did great work. And I loved it, but it took me a while. It took me those 5 or 6 years in architecture school to realize that while I love architecture, I just don't think I'm a really good practitioner of it. I just don't think I have that spark, that X factor. And that was always in the back of my head, whereas writing was always in the front of my head. I was passionate about it, so I was writing the articles and so on. And then in 2000, I had some good fortune. I had been working on a couple of screenplays. It was maybe my second or third script. And just like with you guys, contests can be great things. So there's a contest in Hollywood called the Nickel Fellowship, and that's sponsored by AMPUS, the group that puts on the Academy Awards. It's a pretty prestigious contest, and if you win, it basically opens the door right away. You get an agent, a manager, a lawyer, all the things you need to be a screenwriter in Hollywood. So in 2000, I was fortunate, and I won that. And at the same time, maybe about half a year before, actually, an old friend of mine, we went to high school and college together, had decided, what about opening a dive bar? And I was into architecture, and like I say, I was doing it, but didn't think I was great at it. And the appeal of the bar world was it would leave me my mornings free to write, because we wouldn't open until 4 p.m. And I'm a morning writer. I'm kind of a short sprint guy. Basically, between 6 in the morning and 10 are my best hours. After that, it's sort of diminishing returns in terms of the quality of my thinking. But this gave me that free. And it also allowed me, because I wasn't bartending, I was kind of in an ownership role, I had my own schedule. So I could run down to L.A. for meetings. And it was a tool. The bars were a tool, really, to give me the free time and the extra income to pursue the screenwriting. And over time, though, it turned out I did love them. I love dive bars. So these are red and black and loud and dark, and the bathrooms are filthy and nasty. It's just the drinks are cheap and stiff, and that's the kind of place I like to go. I'm not that much of a cocktail upscale type guy. So these two were definitely in that wheelhouse. And it turned out, yes, they were a tool to keep the writing going, but I also loved, I'm a music freak, so I got to DJ at my own places and stock the jukebox, the CD jukebox. That's how old these places are. We opened in 99 and 2000, back-to-back, both places. I could stock it with only the CDs that I burned, so every song I loved because it was my choice. No store-bought CDs. And just one little update, so post-pandemic and where I am in life and so on, and shifting a little from screenwriting into novel writing, I did sell one of the bars. The Ruby Room has been sold, so I no longer own it, but a lovely couple, they have a great Ethiopian restaurant half a block away called the Blue Nile have taken over. They're keeping it the same. It's going to be the same loud dive bar. And I still have Radio Bar as a place that I majority owner of. So that's kind of the background of how I landed in it. A bit of a fluke and a bit of a vehicle to do it. But, you know, once you're in there, the bars are really just community centers that sell alcohol to keep the lights on. So you end up making friendships and meeting great people. And it's also a great thing for a writer because you just have so much exposure to so many people wandering in and out of your life.
Oh my, I love the story. I love when we take a little sidestep just to see where people came from and you know, how they came about to do what they do today. Very wise of you to use it as a vehicle just from the time frame standpoint. Is like, okay, I can only write in the morning. What do I do with the rest of the day? And then to incorporate that, as you say, with almost food for writing and screenplays, just think of all the characters that must pass in and out of those bars.
Right. And there are specific characters and moments that are in the book that show up maybe as anecdotes or just the way someone speaks. And I can think of a very specific bartender or a patron or something I saw that made its way into my creative life.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I love how you've just woven your entire life together. It just makes so much sense. And you know what? Also to realize that you're in the middle of practicing architecture and you realize that you enjoy it, but that it's not where you shine, it's not where you need to be. And so many people stay in that stuck position and don't make the escape. And I just think your story is very inspiring to those who might feel the same way about whatever it is they're doing.
Right. And I thank you. And I encourage people to do it. You can imagine the conversation. So I was raised by a single mom. You know, she was a first generation immigrant. She worked two jobs to put me through Catholic school, just a superhero, the hero of my life. So there I finished college with my architecture degree. And can you imagine me telling her 7 years later, hey, Mom, that degree I got? Yeah, not going to really use it. I think I'm going to open a bar and try to hand it screenplays. So after she got over her initial shock, which took maybe a year, she accepted that this was okay. But the point is, sometimes, you know, you do need to make the hard U-turn. And by nature, I'm kind of risk averse, but it did seem somehow more solid to leave my 9-to-5 and jump into something like the bar world, which I knew nothing about, because the area seemed to not really have a place like that. So I took the plunge, and I'm very glad I did, because it afforded me, you know, my life since 2000, which has been the screenplays and now the novel, and it's been great.
Yep. And on the flip side of that, as a parent, when your child approaches you with such decisions, typically you would say and shut it down and say, absolutely not. So here's a nod to parents to say, hey, you might want to cut a little slack because the child just might know what they're talking about and what they need.
Yes, and I have two grown sons. They're 23 and 27. And just based on my own experience of having kind of tossed aside my my degrees, when they were enrolling for college, I had not a word to say about their major. Mm-hmm. They picked what they wanted, and I told them, of course, just follow your heart. And I think if you don't have the freedom at age 17 or 18, when you're relatively unencumbered, to pursue your passions, I mean, when are you? Yeah. So I kind of go the opposite of, hey, buckle down and take STEM classes only. They pay the best later, et cetera. Because, you know, you have your whole life to worry about bills and rent. Yep. At 17 or 18, I hope you're idealistic and want to just follow your bliss, you know, whether there's money or prestige in it or not.
Right. Seize the day, right?
Seize the day. There's only one today, and so you might as well enjoy it, right?
You're awesome. Thank you for sharing this little side journey we just took. All right, now we're going to get down to your book. So 180 days, maybe give us a peek into the book.
Okay, well, let's start with the title. I'm not sure how many listeners are aware. There's something called the cooling off period in California. So when you decide to divorce and you go down to the courthouse and you're ready to just get it done, by law, the court says, not so fast. There is something called the cooling off period. It's a mandatory 180-day waiting period before a divorce can be finalized. And I just love that this has been enshrined in law. So you have to imagine enough couples have, you know, in an angry mode, in a fit of pique, rush down to the courthouse, ready to just end it all. And the courts say, we've seen this before. Cool down. Think about it. Maybe you'll change your mind. So it's literally a law. And I thought that that's just a great setup for a book or a movie or just, it's just a great also a reflection that people have done this enough that even the law recognizes it. So in our story, you have an ambitious young architect, Tomas Arrieta, who aspires to be a great man. You know, the next Frank Lloyd Wright or Frank Gehry or Zaha Hadid or, you know, pick your favorite design icon. And he's always comparing himself to this. And he gets in some trouble when one afternoon he's with a client and he has a one afternoon stand. And so then his wife, Naomi Curran, herself a designer, and she actually was a TA in college, so they have some kind of competitive design baggage in their background, discovers the infidelity, and she runs down to the courthouse. And that's where they discover, wait a minute, not so fast, 180 days. So that kicks off the story. Tomas has 180 days to win Naomi back. And then from there, the exploration branches outward. But that's kind of the quick, in Hollywood, what we call the elevator pitch.
Mm-hmm. It's so shocking to me that that is, it's still a law?
It's still a law, yeah.
Wow. I'm just really surprised, especially in California, that just seems like such a strict law where it doesn't allow people to have any autonomy to make their own decisions.
I know. It's just it's surprising to me. When I first read that tidbit, it stuck with me for the exact same reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know there's all kinds of crazy laws on the book. I just saw one the other day that it's illegal in a certain town in Georgia to eat chicken wings with a knife and fork.
Great. Well, you know, I guess if the people have spoken, the people have spoken. Who knows how that? I would love to know the backstory of that. But great, yeah, wonderful.
Wow. So, did you pull the premise of this story from any real life situations, or was it just the fact that you learned about this law that tickled your brain to say, "Hey, this would make a good book storyline"?
Yeah. So I learned about it years ago. So I was doing research. I was rewriting a script called Twice Upon a Time about a couple that divorces and then remarries 10 years later. So I was just doing all kinds of research on marriage laws and how this stuff actually works. And that's where I came across it. And I just kind of, it always stuck with me, but this was maybe 15 years ago. And at the time I didn't do anything with it, but it never left my brain. And to give you all some other sort of further picture on the book. So the subtitle of the book is Infidelity, Architecture, Punk Rock, Clonazepam. So those four elements, actually, when you read the book, you'll see I think I've done my best to intertwine them and have them all make sense. They're not capriciously put in there. Mm-hmm. They're all about the journey of these two people, Thomas and Naomi. And so each of those subheadings has some bearing in my personal life, or my friend's personal life. So I'll give you an example, the clonazepam. So I'm not sure if your listeners know, it's a fast-acting anti-anxiety drug, like a Xanax or mm-hmm. Valium in the 70s.
Right.
This good friend of mine, we both got married very young, right out of college. And he's a very kind of abrasive guy, but I still like him. And he and his wife, when they would get into difficult situations, like a very difficult argument over money, the kids, who knows, you name it, right? He had come up with this idea where he would split a clonazepam and they would each have a glass of wine and cool down before they had the hard conversation. I just thought this was brilliant. Like, what a great idea. You take a chill pill and maybe you won't end up just screaming at each other and not communicating. And the bottom line here is that he's still married and I'm not. So he figured something out. So that obviously, that's literally the clonazepam piece of the book, and it comes in that way. So yes, every book is kind of, I think, autobiographical, even if it's not literally
sure.
Pieces that are from your life. Certainly tonally, it'll be your voice and how you see the world. So that's one example of pulling from real life, in addition to the 180-day cooling off period.
Mm-hmm. It's just so fantastic. Now, you also care to delve into Naomi's plight as well. So it's not just seen from Tomas's viewpoint.
That's right. I think, you know, when I tell people about the book, I guess it's about infidelity, but I hate saying just that because I feel like infidelity is just the starting point of the book. That once you have a rupture of trust, that kind of a huge bomb in a relationship, it's not just, oh, can he win her back? Yes, that's the way I pitch it. But the truth is, does she want to be won back? Mm-hmm. Does he really want to stay together? If so, why? And it forces both of them to really probe, wait a minute, like, is this relationship even worth saving? Are we just going to be driving around, you know, in a car with one or two flat tires, sort of doing this out of habit or because we're afraid of change? Do we even really want to stay together? And to do that, I think a big part of the book, and I would say the umbrella theme of the whole book, is validation. How we derive our sense of self-worth There's kind of the external stuff we all like, you know, the pat on the back, the good grade at school, the promotion at work, somebody saying you're funny, handsome, you name it, whatever it is makes you feel good about yourself. And that's external. And then there's also the internal stuff where I think we just know in our gut, in our heart, like, wow, I made a really good meal, or the garden I planted, well, that looks beautiful, or this dress I sewed, whatever your thing is, mm-hmm. you just kind of know in your heart, in your gut, like, this is good, and I feel good about myself. And I think there's the constant tension of the external versus internal, because external stuff, yes, it's great. You know, hey, look, I won the contest with you guys. That's a pat on the back from an outsider, and yes, I feel really good about it. On the other hand, I also feel like I can be too reliant on other people telling me I've done a good job. So that goes back to being a kid in school and, you know, thinking, well, I got an A, and isn't that great? Because, of course, you're putting your self-worth, your happiness in the hands of other people. And that's a very capricious, and I think it could be a dangerous thing to do, but I also think it's very human. I think we all do it and we all need it. But we also then have our own internal metrics. So Naomi is struggling with all of this, right? Which is, well, I'm a designer too, but I'm not forever comparing myself to these great, unattainable superstars. I'm pretty content. I do these fun, playful design windows for Macy's department store. I'm just me alone. I'm practically wrapped in butcher paper. No one can see me, but I know what I'm doing. I know when it's good, and I love it. And isn't that enough? Like, why do you need the constant other pats on the back? I mean, the whole thing, this is not a huge spoiler or anything, but the trouble begins, really, it comes down to one word, which is the client who Thomas has the one afternoon stand with tells him she thinks he's a genius. He hears that G word, genius, something he feels he's not getting at home. He's not getting the validation he wants from Naomi, and he acts on it. You know, in a weak moment, he's flattered, and his ego is fluffed up, and he does. He sleeps with this person, and then he has to kind of unpack that over the next course of the book, and Naomi also has to unpack, well, is that the kind of man I met? And wait a minute, do I have blind spots too? Like, do I have some flaws? Because in the beginning, I think she comes across as, to my mind, damn near perfect, but I hope the book then over time unpacks that she too isn't perfect. And that's, you know, the book is obviously just jam-packed with flawed characters. I think it's very reality grounded, and that's my intention.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, as you're speaking about validation, that's very interesting. I don't think people in general stop to think about where they sit with the whole validation issue, you know, and their needs for external validation, or if they can internally validate themselves. And then you mix that up with whole family members, whether it's a spouse and or parents or children. And to understand somebody else's need for validation or what they need to feel validated, that goes untouched as well. So you can see how just relationships are difficult just because of that one validation concept.
Yes, and it's funny you say that because my girlfriend, we've been together for 5 years. I think just on a lark, online you can go and you do these love language quizzes, right? Like, what's your love language? Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny stuff. It's kind of akin to astrology a little bit, let's say, which I also enjoy. I'm a Virgo, and I'm very Virgo, actually, in terms of being anal and detail-oriented and all those things. But anyways, we did it, and we were laughing about it because her love language is physical touch. So on the couch together, you know, just kind of sitting side by side, all those things matter a lot to her, and they actually really do. And for me, mine came down to words of affirmation, literally someone telling me, oh, you wrote a good book. So I was just laughing because it was so on the money. And then I also tease her that she got off easy. All she has to do is come home and say, hey, you're smart. She's done. Whereas I have to like spend true time holding her hand. And I have the hard work to do. but yes, of course, that's part of the question of how we look at and where we find validation. Mm-hmm. It's tricky.
Very much so. And your book is also about second chances. And that's a thought. I mean, I don't think people think about, you know, how do you feel about second chances, or does it depend on the situation?
I do believe in second chances. I think most people do, because unless you really believe you're perfect, I don't know how you cannot believe second chances, unless it's something just absolutely egregious. So I think for Naomi especially, she's the one who's in the driver's seat. Tomas decides he really does feel badly and wants to get back together in a genuine way. That's why he goes on the journey where he meets his punk rock icon, Evo Corman, where he meets Lala Rios. an older woman who has been married a very long time and is a widower. So he meets all kinds of people who help him understand himself. He gets to probe inward. And Naomi does the same, and she does it through meeting up with old friends who have secrets she never heard about, or getting close to her parents who themselves had a split that she never really probed when she was younger. So she, too, is on this journey of, wait a minute, is there room for a second chance? And to want a second chance, I think you have to first come to the conclusion you think this thing is worth salvaging. And then if you do, then comes the heavy lifting and the hard work of making that second chance happen and taking the massive risk. Will you or won't you give the person another chance? Because then I feel like you just keep backing up into other big questions, because that backs up into the question of, fundamentally, do you think people can change? Mm-hmm. If you don't, then probably no, this person's unsalvageable in your mind. But if you actually think, well, wait a minute, I've changed in that situation, maybe they can change in that situation. And then you just have to watch and sort of test it out. And in the end, I think there's always going to be a leap of faith involved. Either way, whether you say no, maybe, or yes to the second chance, you go a certain distance with kind of, I don't want to call it scientific, but you know what you observe and their behavior and so on. But in the end, you also have to be willing to take the plunge.
Right, right. So obviously your book is very rich in so many other ideas and concepts and feelings and raw and real that really transcend that little short elevator pitch you gave us.
That's right. And I'm hoping that comes across. So I think I work on the back blurb of the book. Here's the way I see it, Pat. I figured, look, in a bookstore or online, I get one shot with the cover. So if the title and those four words, infidelity, architecture, punk rock, clonazepam, if that doesn't grab you, I'm screwed. But if I get you, and you flip the book over, and then you can read the paragraph synopsis as well, then maybe I have a chance that you'll actually open the book and want to read it. Mm-hmm. So I worked on that very hard, and the point I'm just making by mentioning all this is that the key sentence in the back for me is, the infidelity is only the beginning of this journey. Yes. Because I do think it's about a lot more. And I want it to be about a lot more. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, a lifetime of experience that I want reflected in there. And we are going to look at things that I'm passionate about, So, for example, Tomas tells us a lot about his feelings on Michelangelo's three Pietà sculptures. Naomi talks about what Disneyland Adventures Through Inner Space meant to her. And those are just a couple, pop culture references. Mm-hmm. But the point is, I hope I explore them well. And music, of course, is massive in the book. What it means, that's another version of the arts that are important to me and to the characters. So, yeah, I do want the book, I definitely want to convey that the book is about much more than the infidelity. That definitely is a kicking off point, and it's important, of course. It's a big breach of trust. But beyond that, it's really going to be about two people really turning the microscope inward and looking at themselves and giving a kind of an honest appraisal of who they are, where they are, and what they want.
And speaking of music, you did stick in some little musical references that maybe people might not recognize, but you do. I guess they call them Easter eggs.
Right. So, and there I hope, I've had a few people, there's also a lot of architectural Easter eggs in the book. Mm-hmm. So people have looked up buildings that I've mentioned that are important to the characters. And the music is the same for me. I it's like I was saying as we began our conversation, how I, in my own jukebox at the Ruby Room bar, I would only allow CDs that I burn myself. So music is ultra important. And in the book, except for the fictitious character of Ivo Gorman, everything else in there, if it piques your curiosity in the least, you can hop onto Spotify or YouTube and check out the music. And the point is, really, like, for me, even if I'm reading something where I'm not a great aficionado on something, let's say I'm reading a book and someone's going into detail about, customizing a car, fixing up a car, let's say, or repairing a computer or cooking an elaborate meal, I may not understand everything I'm reading or even what some of the words mean, but the point is, you understand that this is something that the character is super passionate about. It means a lot to them. And if I like the character and something means a lot to them, I'm along for that ride. And I might actually look up what that ingredient in that dish was or something like that, in the same way that I hope people look up the songs and some of the buildings I mentioned.
Yep. I do that so many times as I'm reading. If something catches my eye, I'll save it for later and go look it up and take you down another rabbit hole that you didn't plan on doing. But that's how you learn. You mentioned the cover, and it's very wise to create a cover that pulls you in so that the next step of flipping it over to the back actually occurs. Tell us about the front cover, because it's wild.
Yes, all glory and honor to Danielle Kohler. She is a graphic artist who works at Kohler Books Publishing. So I knew just from the punk stuff in the book and my own taste, I gravitate toward big kind of pop art images. So I don't really go for cluttered books that are too cluttered in the front. I prefer kind of clean, bright images that feel like a painting, kind of. And I had told Danielle a few ideas, and I said, but hey, you know what, feel free to surprise me. And she had read the book, so she understood the kind of the punky tone of it, the characters, the feel of it. And she came back with, hands down, the best design. And I had, she proposed four or five, and I talked to a few good friends, the people, you know, whose opinions I trust, to make sure they were in line with me. And almost to a person, they all agreed. So I think she did a great job of capturing the tone of the book. She captured the kind of frantic urgency, the way that numbers descend. I love the dark cover. A few things I did talk about and suggest to her is having stark back colors, like black with colors that pop on the front. So you're like, is this like a knockoff Warhol? What am I, mm-hmm. you know, what am I looking at here?
Yeah.
And I wanted something catchy and big and not too cluttered, so that, you know, from 10 feet away, it might jump out at you. And I think she nailed it, and it's definitely in my taste zone.
Let's see, is that George or Dottie?
Both. They're in a different room, so I can't tell. I thought I went far enough away there. I'm sure they saw a squirrel or a tree outside and are losing their minds. Yes.
<That's funny. laughs> You know, I've had so many positive encounters with authors who have published through Kohler Books. So shout out to them.
Yeah. So when it came time for me to pick a publisher, I had a few offers, and I want to get his title right. It's not the submission. It may be the submissions editor, a guy named Greg Field. So I got a couple responses from various publishers saying, hey, we're interested, and that's all great. But nothing like what he did. So Greg Field is his name. And he wrote back a single-spaced, very dense email, a page or two, discussing his love of the book. And he proved it. Like, he was talking about individual characters, not just Tomas and Naomi, but the side characters and how they played. And it was just so clear to me that he was passionate about it, number one. And two, he had read it very, very closely. Mm-hmm. And he was even quoting certain lines back to me. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, what do you think? I mean, get your honest opinion on Kohler versus other places. And he said that Kohler had just an intimate, close process. And I kind of jumped at that. You know, I think part of the PTSD of being a professional screenwriter is, you know, you've got 50 different people asking for changes at different times, from the studio to the actor to the director. And it can feel very not intimate, just like you're responding to a batch of notes. You don't know,
right,
kind of where they're coming from. You're trying to decipher. But he described a very close working process, and he was right. It turned out to be it was just a wonderful process. My editor was great. The publisher himself, John Kohler, you know, he wanted to have before we even signed, like a one-on-one Zoom to meet me. I mean, who does that?
Yes.
What head of a company wants to meet their author and chat with them and get a feel for them? And so all of that, just, I guess I realized I need that as mm-hmm. a writer, that's where I flourish. Mm-hmm. So it's been a great experience. And I think they've got, you know, hey, obviously it's a self-serving comment, but yes, I think Kohler Books has a great taste.
Well, congratulations on finding somebody. You know, that's a big challenge in and of itself.
That's true. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. So what's next? What are you working on now?
Okay. So I'm doing some screenplay work, but I'm really excited. I'm about, I want to say three-fourths through a draft of my next novel. It's called Strawberry Ice Cream, and it's about caring for your aging and possibly your parent with dementia or Alzheimer's.
Ooh, wow.
I'm at that point in my life. My mother's 84, and these are challenges I never saw coming. I think when you're growing up and getting older, there's a bazillion books on having children. I remember What to Expect When You're Expecting, and that's just one of so many, and so many videos. I feel like life sort of prepares you, okay, this is going to be a big deal, having a kid is a big commitment, all those things, which of course are true. But somehow, I thought I never it's criminally under-discussed what a change and what a phase of your life that caring for your aging parent is. So this is going to be about a guy who is absolutely at his wit's end. He's frustrated. He feels guilty for feeling frustrated, in short, with his mom, all those things. And he decides to open a brick-and-mortar school. He feels like, why aren't there schools for teaching people how to care for your aging parent? Now, he's not perfect. When I say a school, I'm talking about a cheap mini mall storefront he runs for a few months in the hopes of someone showing up and maybe together talking to other people in the same position, they'll actually come up with some ways to not go crazy and to actually find the joy in seeing their older parent change, because that's what happens. So that's the next one, and I'm really excited about it. And I think it's, like I said, the biggest thing to me is that I talk to some of my friends and we all go, oh, you're having the same feeling. So that tells me that there's a lot of people out there who probably feel kind of alone or overwhelmed, and hopefully this brings them some comfort.
Oh my gosh, I love this book already. Thank you for writing this. Yeah, I was one of those adult children who kind of was thrown into a situation caring for my mom. She didn't have dementia, but she had medical issues due to a malpractice issue in a hospital. Oof. That just left her struggling for 9 years. And towards the very end, I think I lost my mind. I just there was nothing left of me. And then when she passed away, it took me several years to figure out who the heck I was without her. So there is so much there. So I'm looking forward to strawberry ice cream.
Thank you. Yeah, I sympathize with what you've experienced. You know, you get to your wit's end, and everyone counsels, well, you have to make time for self-care you know, be kind to yourself. But, you know, in the moment, that's very hard to do. And as you say, you are losing your mind, and I've had those moments too. And, you know, it's also, this whole process is also called the long goodbye. And mm-hmm. I think it's a very long goodbye, and it's very hard to see changes like that in your loved one. And it's frustrating, and some days you're good and you're patient and you're full of warmth. Other days, if you're like me and you're human, I think you're snappy and you're short, and then you feel guilty about it. And then lather, rinse, repeat. You know, you go through it all over and over. So I want to try to portray those things honestly, but also maybe offer some hope and some ideas on just finding just the good day or two and finding your best self in that situation. It's not a rah-rah book. It's going to be portrayed realistically, but it's also just like the other book. I think there's hope in it.
Oh, absolutely. Just for people to realize that what they're feeling is not unique, that they're not alone, that they're not strange, that they're not mean, that these are all natural feelings. So I am very much excited about this. Please keep me posted.
I will, of course.
Oh, you're a good one. So anything we missed that you wanted to highlight today?
You know, Pat, I think we've got it all. So I hope that... The big thing I want to bring across, of course, is the idea of validation, because I think we can all relate to it, in addition to all the other things in the book. But no, we touched on it. We touched on George and Dottie and Lester and Bella Kitty and the bars and music. So I think anyone listening, you have a pretty good sense of maybe hopefully the book and a little bit of who I am and where I'm coming from. And yes, so I want to thank you for all that.
Oh, for sure. What we are missing, though, is any contact information. So just send us where we need to go.
Yes. Thank you. I would have completely forgotten about that. I'll start with the author website. And that's kind of fun for folks. It's my name. It's alfredobotello.com. So A-L-F-R-E-D-O, B as in boy, O-T-E-L-L-O.com. So yes, it's got the book in it. But what I want to point to is the drop-down menu in the upper right corner. You will find some more, like we talked earlier, Easter eggs. So there are 20 years worth of DJ flyers from the bars. So you get a sense of the pop art that I like. There's actually the covers, I made the CD jukebox covers with all the music. If you want to know what music I do and don't like, you'll find out what was on the jukebox that's also in there, as well as some Spotify playlists that are connected to the book, yes, because of punk and power pop, but also there's ska and dark wave, new wave. You know, the genres that to me are important. So, you know, if you like them, great, listen to them. And if not, well, then you can just say, God, the guy has terrible taste, but that's okay. at least I know what he's into. So there's that. And then Instagram is another good place to find me. And that's Alfredo Botello Author, with underscores between Alfredo and Botello and Author. So you can find me there with some posts, and that links to my Facebook, which is also Alfredo Botello. And I think by then you should be exhausted and sick of me between those.
Excellent. All right. We are speaking with Alfredo Botello, and the title of the book is 180 Days, alfredobotello.com. I knew we were going to have a good time. I knew you were just going to be so vibrant and lively and have so much to talk about, and you did not disappoint. Thank you so much for today. Keep me posted on strawberry ice cream. Let's stay in touch, and you're welcome here anytime.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and to anyone out there listening, thanks for taking the time. I really do appreciate it.